You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Give Darren McGarvey a lovely Greenbelt welcome. Darren will no doubt be saying more about his books later, but originally he won the Orwell Prize in 2018 for this book, Poverty Safari. It says that the award was given for shining a light on brave writing, uncovering hidden lives and uncomfortable truths. That sounds quite a lot like what we do in Greenbelt. Darren McGarvey.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you all. Apologies that I was slightly late. I was quite uncharacteristically optimistic about how long it would take to get from the Holiday Inn Express in Kettering to here. But I can see that things are very well organised, more organised than I am. And the minute that I arrived on site, I was whisked here and had the brief sensation of feeling slightly important, which is always quite a dangerous thing for someone like me. I don't know how many people here are familiar with me or how many of you are taking shelter from the heavens. But I am just trying to pad out the first couple of minutes just to give you a sense of me, which may offer you some kind of investment or way in to the presentation that I plan this morning. Primarily, most of the people who have come to my work at various points or have seen me on television or heard me on radio, they will be familiar with the blend of social, political analysis and what has come to be known as lived experience, which is a phenomenon which you might not be consciously aware of, but you will be interacting with or consuming on a daily basis. This is any form of content, social media, books, television, drama, reality television, which relies primarily on the personal adversities of the individual to create for you a sense of engagement, entertainment, perhaps the false sense that you're being informed on some broader social issue. And my work going forward over these next few months, which will culminate in a book as of yet untitled, is going to be focused on this phenomenon. This phenomenon where we rely on people who may be still quite vulnerable to disclose intimate details of their lives in order to elucidate for you the deeper issues around matters such as poverty, marginalisation based on ethnicity, religion, sexual expression, as well as issues like gender-based violence, drug addiction. Many of you may even find yourselves working in sectors where lived experience is deployed with varying degrees of sincerity and care in order to drive public relations campaigns, funding applications, and creating a level of visibility for particular issues, which it's seen that public ignorance is a major barrier to moving forward on systemic barriers to things. So now that I've drained any sense of optimism or fun out of the room and really made you feel like you've travelled all this way and you're some sort of third sector delegation, I'm now going to take you on a little roller coaster. I'm aware this is a family festival, and so I will be mindful of that, but I will say that I will be talking about trauma. I will be drawing from some of my lived experiences, and if that is a little heavy for some of you, there are people around that you can speak to. But also I will say, and I will say this firmly, often performers, writers, anyone who gets up at an event, particularly at the Edinburgh Fringe where I've just been vomited out from, there's this tremendous emphasis for the performer to be mindful of all of the potential ways that a member of the audience might be upset or triggered or react sensitively And while I always operate on a compassionate basis, I will firmly remind everyone that the most vulnerable person in any performance space is the performer. That's the person everyone's looking at. That's the person everyone is depending on to steer the thing home. That's the person who's probably exhausted from travelling. The person who's taken a great financial risk to put on a production. And that is the person who is offering up intimate aspects of their own lives for your entertainment, for your dissection. And so let's make sure we get the balance right when we come into a performance space, thinking about who really is vulnerable. Of course, that idea that we need to be mindful and somehow predict all of the individual subjective interpretations of people that we don't know and what they might get upset by. It's one of the many facets of what I call trauma discourse. And that is something that I hope to gently critique, not just today, but going forward with all of my work. Does this sound like something vaguely interesting? That's what we call a false sense of security. I really wish my wife had arrived. Maybe she is here. Becky, are you here? Yeah. Nice one. Brilliant. Make some noise for my darling wife, Becky. You see, if I had known she was here, then that opening 10 minutes wouldn't have gone as well. Because I would have been so, my mind would have been so bent on trying to impress her that I would have overthought everything and not been able to just be myself and relax, which is when all the best stuff actually happens. The feeling that something terrible is about to happen never leaves me for long. Whatever public face I portray privately, I am always preparing for the final calamity. When I can't reach my wife by phone long after she is due home, I worry she may be mangled in a traffic accident. Stood in the playground waiting for my children to come out of school at the end of the day, I have suffered dreadful surges of anxiety that one of them may have gotten lost in the 50-yard walk from the gate and the entrance after I dropped them off. I imagine the moment a teacher insists my son never came to school in response to my asking where he is. Whenever I get a call from a family member, I inhale deeply before answering, anticipating an emergency or death. And in my role as a writer and commentator, paid to express my opinions publicly with self-assurance, behind the curtain, I live in fear of punishment, humiliation, or some other cruel form of reprisal. All for the crime of expressing my thoughts and feelings. I feel in daily life for long stretches of most days, the way I imagine fearful flyers must, 30,000 feet above the earth. And to borrow a well-worn turn of phrase, for me, turbulence is other people. I can't be around anyone for too long without feeling a strong urge to leave, even just momentarily, to catch my proverbial breath. Moreover, I do not go anywhere unless I have an exit plan in place, and I become restless and agitated the longer I must linger. Mid-conversation, I may tune out and become preoccupied by facial expressions and body language or what's going on around or behind me. My social instincts seem calibrated for a particular purpose. They seem set to detect, track, and anticipate in every interaction I have the intention, temperament, and mood of the other person. It could be a stranger on a bus, a well-wisher at a book signing, or my own wife walking in the door from work. What I need to know before anything else can happen is that I am safe and secure. And I have been like this for as long as I can remember. Into the bargain, every now and then, for no reason at all, Scenes from what feel like my past project themselves intrusively onto the busy wall of my waking mind. These scenes do not follow any specific pattern. They are not triggered by any specific stimulus, and I rarely recall them voluntarily. Yet when they do arise, it can feel very much like I've never stopped thinking about them. I couldn't even tell you which order the events fall on my internal timeline. All I can say is that for most of my life, these little movies have been playing in the dark recesses of what I have always assumed to be my memory. Despite my recollection that almost all of them occurred before I was 10 years old, their detail remains vivid. I could not say what year each event took place, nor what happened the days before or after. These movies exist only as contextless fragments connected by one thread. They were all, I believe, experienced by me. And this is where I take the safety harness off. There's a part of me that's broken far beyond repair. You can sense it as you run your fingers through my hair. Because people couldn't be trusted or depended upon. Where deprivation is not a term, it's a terrible norm. It's gravely complicated, I fear. My old dear wasn't the type to ovulate in IKEA. But since you're asking, I remember it like yesterday. Drunken strangers linger in the room. Make sure my fly's not down. That would really undermine the sense of drama. Drunken strangers linger in the room with vulgar things to say. Blood in the pan. Spiders living in the litter tray. Deacon Blue singing about a ship called Dignity. In hindsight, that's where I learned how to kill the pain. As they plunge those dirty needles deep into their veins. Wrecked sinuses, blood-borne viruses. Oh, to be the apple of Dionysus' irises. So I'm sorry if sometimes I seem angry or hateful. If this is privilege, then I'll work on being more grateful. And they sneer when I talk about poverty. And they sneer when I talk about my Pollock days. In the land of social justice, where you invite a cringe if you talk wrong or you don't own property. I speak the kind of truth that could turn the tide. If only they could shut their mouths the way they've shut their minds. But they tell me all's well. Home of the brave. They don't want freedom. They just want a different coloured chain. Huddled in a dark room, scared to talk, while he kicked the door in, screaming threats through the letterbox. One day she'd kick him out and swear she's no joking. Next day they're shagging with the bedroom doors open. One kid tied to a chair, another kicked across a flare. That means floor in Scottish. I'm helpless to help, even though I was there. When these thoughts occur, it's like I'm in a daily rut. It happened so long ago, I wonder if I made it up. A terrapin floats lifeless in an old pan. Then she'd pour a dram. That's when I'd watch her mind wander. Like a dirty old man's stone-cold hands. Her and death cheek to cheek in a slow dance. My old man raised us by himself and though never a drinker. Chronic stress will make a mess of a sensitive thinker. So I'm sorry if I fail to keep a straight face when you are at university telling me that it's not a safe space. And they sneer when I talk about poverty. And they sneer when I talk about my Pollock days and the land of social justice where you invite a cringe if you talk wrong or you don't own property. I speak the kind of truth that could turn a tide. If only they could shut their mouths the way they've shut their minds. But they tell me all's well. Home of the brave. They don't want freedom. They just want a different colour chain. Now, you guys might find that that was interesting for different reasons than I think it's interesting, that performance. You see, it doesn't conform to the natural rhythm that we've been conditioned to expect when people talk about trauma. When people talk about trauma, whether they realise it or not, they tell a story that conforms to a classic three-act structure. So the story begins by the setup, setting the scene. Then we have the journey into the adversity, the belly of the beast moment. Before, we have the resolution, which, if told well, should leave us feeling informed, inspired, elated even. So I want to apologise for not telling a story that conforms to that three-act structure, because I refuse to wrap the reality of trauma in a narrative bow, because anyone in the audience who has ever experienced real trauma that passes a clear clinical threshold will know that that is not how trauma works. So what you've just heard from me is referred by many in the field as oversharing. How many of you class yourselves as oversharers? Hands up. And how many of you think that you overshare because you have poor boundaries because of trauma? And how many have diagnosed that problem through Instagram? I diagnosed myself with type 2 ADHD on the way here. It may not surprise you that somewhere along the line, I acquired the idea that my life was uniquely tragic. However, when this notion took shape, I cannot be sure. Was it the alcoholic mother whose unreliability plagued my early years? Maybe the deprived community I was raised in, notable for the poverty, violence and addiction it so effortlessly produced? Perhaps leaving the family home abruptly at 16 before becoming a homeless alcoholic in my early 20s was the genesis of this narrative? Or possibly the reactions of shock and sadness on other people's faces when I regaled them with detailed accounts of family dysfunction? Perhaps that is what did the job. Whichever way this idea took root, whether a sudden epiphany or a gradual view constructed over many years, the belief that my upbringing was hard and had damaged me beyond repair at some stage became the controlling idea of my story. A story which was almost as hard to bear as the trauma itself. Like many of my generation, a reluctant millennial. I was actually disgusted when I found out that I was a millennial, having spent the prior 3 years joking about millennials and their narcissism and their desire to talk only about themselves and their hypersensitivity to criticism. Yeah, it was a bit of a humbling moment. My cohort blossomed in a cultural sweet spot where information was becoming more accessible, but the tentacles of the internet weren't quite scurrying around in our pockets like they are now. It was a less informed but simpler time to be young, when traditional media always got the last word on what was true, on who was good or bad, and on what was considered cool. And the family doctor always got the last word on what was wrong when you didn't feel well. Back then, pop stars and not podcasts ruled the airwaves. What many of the artists of the day were singing, shouting or rapping about was their personal problems. Unlike the moody grunge of Nirvana, where listeners were often left to speculate as to the true meaning behind the lyrics to a song like Underneath the Bridge, the biggest pop stars of my day were far more literal when offering their perspectives. Queen's gangster rapper 50 Cent traded on being shot 9 times. Kanye West captured the charts with his account of a near-fatal car crash that left him with his jaw wired. Though perhaps the story with the biggest impact on me of any artist in this period of putting it all out there was burgeoning global superstar Eminem's account of trailer park poverty, marital dysfunction and the child neglect he experienced at the hands of his pill-popping alcoholic mother. beamed into millions of homes, cars, headsets, every hour of the day. These artists didn't want to change the world like Public Enemy, or wax poetic on the pitfalls of modernity like Radiohead. These precocious upstarts wanted to talk about themselves and their lived experiences. More than that, they offered detailed accounts of their adversities, which were as shocking as they were intriguing. And by purging their frustrations, their heartaches, and their traumas in their music, they modelled a mode of self-expression to troubled teenagers like me, struggling to forge an identity. This willingness on the part of artists to disclose their personal tribulations publicly in exchange for greater visibility, adulation, financial success, was part of a general shift in culture across all forms of media. The noughties were a golden age of airing dirty linen publicly, and some freak shows were trashier than others. From bear-baiting daytime talk show vehicles to primetime weekend talent shows, men and women routinely risked scandalising themselves for a shot at fortune and fame, for the promise of feeling loved, accepted, and secure. In 2001, grieving my mother's passing and reeling from a family breakdown, I attempted to emulate my favourite artist, seeking salvation, catharsis, and acceptance by hastily upcycling personal adversity into my best attempt at music. The first song I ever wrote was a rap called Seems Like Only Yesterday. The lyrics were written before my mother passed away, before I left home, and were an attempt at reconciliation after many years of feeling angry at her for leaving. Across the four verses, I depicted my experiences of growing up with her as she descended further into alcoholism, as narrated through the eyes of a child. When I wrote the song, I hadn't really considered the idea it would ever be performed. As fate would have it, she passed away before I could ever play it to her, and so it became, by accident, a tribute song of sorts. I recorded it and I liked how it sounded, and soon took rap up as a serious hobby. And that sent me on a journey that's leading me to here today. So many of you will be familiar with lived experience. Many of you may even have put yourselves forward to share your lived experience on social media platforms or at events or as part of political or social campaigns. But one of the big issues that I have with that sort of discourse and that sort of testimony is that it can set in motion a chain of events that a person who isn't quite properly healed from their trauma or doesn't yet possess the necessary insight to truly understand the meaning of what has happened. It can set in motion a chain of events which leads them into a lion's den for all of their triggers. How many of you watched Baby Reindeer? Yeah. How many of you enjoyed it? It was a well put together TV show, but I could only watch one episode of it. I was only able to watch one because to me, the level of detail and the fact that it was actually marketed as this is a true story, it was as upsetting to my nervous system as violent pornography would be to many of you. It felt gratuitous. It felt vulgar. And I wondered if this was an action film, there would have been a stunt coordinator on site to make sure that the actors were not at any risk when attempting to portray scenes that involve fighting or guns or explosives. If it was an erotic film, which I know none of you have ever sat up late at night to watch on Netflix, there would be an intimacy coordinator present to make sure that actors at their most vulnerable were protected and felt safe and secure and supported in the workplace. Now, I don't know if Netflix did have a lived experience consultant on set. If they did think, what are the implications of saying this story is true? Will the person who's written the story be called upon to prove the veracity of their experience in a court of law, for example? How will the person feel when they see millions of people online and commentators all around the world speculating as to who did what and the true identity of this person, and is this person a psychopath, and what does this mean, and basically treating it as if it's just a bunch of figurines in a toy box that kids pick up and just bash off each other while they're playing out little imagination fantasies in their minds. When someone achieves a level of visibility like that, it's very rare. But anyone who goes into the public domain with the aspiration of achieving some kind of catharsis or closure or meaning or a sense that their experience is helping others, they're taking a massive risk. They're taking a massive risk because certain prior conditions have to be met before someone who has experienced trauma is really ready to go through that. And I can say that because I'm one of the people who you see occasionally at things like this, or on television, or on Radio 4, or on a bookshelf in your local bookshop or library. I'm a person who is expected to always braid and blend whatever my analysis or thoughts or commentary is with that propulsion fuel of lived experience. So unlike the Oxbridge educated, everything I say has to be qualified by speaking as a lived experience person, speaking as someone who has recovered from alcoholism and drugs, speaking as someone who has experienced homelessness and residential instability. I often have to remind producers of radio programs, television programs, news programs, do not introduce me as an addict. Do not introduce me as a recovering alcoholic. I will disclose that if I feel that it is relevant. Now, how many people know that I've given a kind of description of what the lived experience person looks and feels like? How many of you have encountered that in culture at some point? Put your hands up. How many of you have read a memoir about growing up in poverty, overcoming the odds, and becoming a success story as a result of doing 12 simple things? How many of you have watched a television drama that draws on the lived experience of a person who's gone through some kind of adversity? So we realise that this is catnip for culture. The intimate details of my life, of potentially your lives, it's catnip because there's something about a real authentic story that draws us in like few other things do. As someone who has told their story publicly and have done since I was a teenager, I would never have imagined the level of visibility that would have come with that eventually. And I would have never have imagined at the beginning when I was telling my story how many times the story would need to be redrafted as I became more mature, as I gained insight, as I moved from a purely victim mentality into a mentality that understands the nuance of my behaviour, that understands that, well, things that shouldn't have happened did happen, and things that should have happened didn't when I was a child. I then became an adult who was culpable and responsible for their own behaviour, and that there are people out there in the world right now who perhaps if they wrote a memoir, I would be the villain in it. You see, this discussion around trauma, this idea that you can submit into public policy my subjective interpretation of my own experience, it's very worrying to me. Yes, lived experience surveyed at some kind of scale can be tremendously useful. And anyone who knows about the specifics of the creation of the welfare state will know that between the First and Second World War, the UK government sent a bunch of middle class, upper class civil servants out across the country to talk to the poor people. They had a sense they were going to have to create some kind of raft of social insurances to protect people from the abyss of capitalism. So they sent the poshos out across the country. And the poshos, if you read the stuff they wrote, it was a bit like the sort of stuff David Attenborough says when he sees hummingbirds mating. You know? And the revelations they experienced were things that people who grew up in poverty could tell you to this day as common sense. There were 900 interviews conducted. Every single person that was interviewed had different political beliefs, different social experiences. They made a different meaning of their struggle. Some people, it was two-parent families. Other people, it was single parents. Father had died. There were alcoholics. Everybody was different. So you couldn't base the welfare state on just talking to a bunch of people who had a particular type of experience. But surveyed at scale, themes began to emerge. And the themes were, no matter how much money these people have got, no matter how well they run their households, they can't seem to make that money last until the end of the week. They always seem to have to resort to some sort of other action in order to create the money necessary for them just to survive and feed their children. That insight was gained from surveying those lived experiences at some kind of scale. But what we have now is lived experience is a form of storytelling. So it's about the catharsis of the storyteller getting that sense of satisfaction that they have upcycled a personal adversity that has some kind of meaning or implication for changing a system. And then we have an audience of people either who get the catharsis of feeling seen because their lived experiences gain some kind of visibility, or the uninformed audience who are gaining insight, apparently, into a particular experience through the individual avatar of one person's interpretation of that experience. Do you see the disparity in the utility of these two different types of lived experience? One type of lived experience, we're trying to get the information in order to create a systemic change. We're trying to have a large sample size. We're trying to see, irrespective of the individual differences between people, is there something that binds them all together? Because that's what we need to zero in on if we're talking about systems change. The other, it has its uses, no doubt, but it receives a level of prominence now that I don't think is necessarily geared towards systemic change. It's a form of individualism. It's about me saying, I will pathologize every idiosyncratic twist of character that I experience as a result of living in a society like this. And then I will go on an inner journey in order to offset all of those natural adaptations and mutations I have undergone to cope with the immense stress of living in this culture, at this time, in this economy. I mean, is it any wonder why some of us can't concentrate? Is it any wonder why some of us can't sleep? Is it any wonder why some of us aren't emotionally available to our children? Is it any wonder why some of us are anxious all the time? I don't know where you live, but where I live, it's pretty intense. The trauma discourse currently doesn't ask us to confront any of that. It asks us to become resilient. It asks us to tell our stories in order to release the trauma. But let me tell you something about trauma, and I'll end on this. If you're getting up on a stage or on a social media post or whatever other vehicle you're using to tell your story of trauma. See, the things you find easy to talk about, that's not where the healing is. The healing is in the stuff you can't talk about. The healing is in the stuff you don't want to look at. And so I gently, perhaps provocatively, acknowledge trauma is widespread. It's the toll we pay for being alive. It sits on a spectrum of severity. But one thing I'll tell you is, working on the front line for a long, long time, the most traumatized people in this country, they don't talk about triggers. They don't talk about flashbacks. They don't even know there's a discussion going on somewhere in culture behind a gate of jargon about trauma. Most people who have trauma don't know they have it. And so when we are talking about trauma, we need to hold that in mind. We really need to think about the accessibility of the discussion, because as far as I can tell, it's become very self-involved. It's become very self-referential. You go out into any prison, you go out into any school in a deprived area, trauma is everywhere. Now, what I want to do now is just open things up a little bit. How does everyone feel about that? It took a kind of took a few turns there, didn't it? It's unusual to hear someone with trauma who talks publicly about it taking that sort of tone, isn't it? Because there's this idea that there's these tropes associated with the person who has trauma, that they're always operating from a place of vulnerability, that their only motive and agenda is to help people. They don't like the attention. They don't like the sense of satisfaction, fleeting as it may be, from telling the story. Then there's all the transactions that they get involved in with charities and organisations and political campaigns. And let me tell you something, if someone is operating from active trauma, that's what's predisposing them to move into that lion's den. So the mad paradox and irony, if you follow me, is that the people who end up on a stage talking about how we recover from trauma are often the most unaware of how active trauma is running amok in their daily lives in terms of the situations that they will put themselves in, the level of insight or lack of they have into the level of trauma that they experience and how that manifests in their intimate relationships and the decisions that they take and their work ethic. So the next time you see someone on a stage talking about trauma, talking about their story, hold space for thinking, I accept this person, I accept what they're saying, but understand that all it is in that moment is just a photograph of how that person is feeling in that moment. It's not a story about anything else. It's not a clue to some massive other systemic issue. And I hope to, with this work going forward, pull some of that conversation back into a place where talking about these things publicly is useful. And also, tooling up the lived experience people who are out there right now, providing all sorts of benefits to organisations, charities, media, without any sense of the emotional labour that that's costing them, without any sense of the duty of care or obligation that third parties have to people with lived experience. Because the minute that trauma is not the trending topic, all these people are going to get dropped. And see, if they're in active trauma, that's going to feel like abandonment. See, if they're in active trauma, that's going to reopen a wound. What I don't want to see is something tragic happening off the back of everybody riding this wave of trauma without really confronting and contemplating the kind of energy we're talking about here. So that should be enough to inspire some questions from you guys. I would hope you did all read the descriptor of what the event was going to be about. Yeah?
Thank you, Darren, for your insight into lived experience and your critique of trauma. I'm sure it has inspired lots of questions. For those of you who would like to ask questions, we will try and move around. We try to curate as many different voices here. So if you haven't spoken at Greenbelt before, please feel able to in this space. But be aware that means we might not get to everybody and we might not necessarily get to the first hand up. We're also recording this talk, so if you don't want to hear your voice for posterity, then please don't ask a question. And some of that has been really quite triggering, potentially for somebody in this room. So again, as Darren said, our lovely well-being and pastoral colleagues in the purple and pale blue jackets are available. So please make use of those opportunities to talk and share concerns later if you'd like to. Right, some questions.
Hi, so thanks for the talk. It was really great the way you described your experiences. So last year, I had a very unexpected trauma diagnosis. And I think the thing that most resonated for me was the not having a story or a language or a way of understanding yourself other than these fragmentary, strange things happen. The impending sense of doom, the sudden panics, and I just thought that was normal and I just needed to try a bit harder to be normal. I think luckily when somebody explained to me, you know, how I was behaving and what was going on, it was in a clinical setting and I was dumped straight into met the clinical threshold, went straight into clinical help, which has been wonderful, and would thoroughly recommend anyone who's listen to this talk and isn't quite sure what to do to pursue a clinical route with the NHS. They were great for me. The question, sorry to ramble a bit, the question is, what would you, I think you've done great at highlighting awareness of what trauma is really like. Moving forwards, what should people do? What did you find was helpful? What would you recommend other people do to, and what would you say good looks like? Because I thought I was going to be cured, and, you know, that's a bit simple. You know, what does good actually look like for you today?
Thanks for your question, and thanks for sharing a bit of your personal experience. I'm wary of getting to a point where I feel like I'm fixed, because I always feel like that's a red flag for me. I remember when I used to go to, like, recovery meetings, and I'm still in recovery meetings, and that's what keeps me sober. But in mutual aid recovery, kind of 12-step recovery, there's a debate that's ongoing about, do we describe ourselves as recovering or do we describe ourselves as recovered? And so some people, they really stand behind the fact that they're recovered because that's the message they want to carry. We can recover. But I'm always anxious about saying that because there's been times where I've been walking around saying that and didn't know I was about to trip up and fall flat on my face in recovery. In terms of trauma, I mean, it's something that comes up and then fades again. But there are certain things that I now understand about it. And that is that I can't actually heal trauma on my own. Trauma is a relational thing. It's relational to other people. It's relational to institutions. It's relational to a community. But what the trauma discourse currently, at least what I can see of it online, what it really says is, through a process of just reflecting on it endlessly, you will be able to teach your nervous system how not to react to things. When in truth, the only thing that will soothe the nervous system is to be placed in the path of the discomfort it's trying to avoid and to learn that not everything that reminds it of the trauma is going to traumatise them. And so just some of the kind of implications of the trauma discourse, I fundamentally resist this idea of warning people that something might upset them. It's better to assume that if you go into a public space, something might happen out with your control that could upset you. That's a safer assumption for me to make. I will not be handing responsibility for my triggers over to anyone else because I don't feel safe doing that. I would say, no, I will not enter that space because I don't know how I feel. That's me taking responsibility for my own health. And that's a much safer bet than just walking in and then just waiting to see what happens. But for me, getting better is about confronting those difficult ideas, those counterintuitive ideas. And you know that on your own journey, that there are things that we have to confront that are harder to talk about. And that's where the work is, and that's where the healing is, or at least that has been my experience. And that's what I hope to share. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. It was brilliant.
Thanks.
I studied social work in, I finished in 1991. I don't remember them mentioning trauma very much back then. I think it is quite a new thing that it's become such a discourse. I really loved that you've picked up on that. Do you think it got worse after COVID? Because of, you know, people were craving something, weren't they, with lockdown? And I think the sort of hit that you get, like you were saying, a dopamine hit of hearing somebody's triumph over adversity was like maybe something everybody needed at that time, you know, to get us through what was traumatic for everybody. But a lot of people hadn't had any experience of trauma, would find lockdown particularly hard, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. Yeah, well, in 2022, the word trauma was Googled more than it ever had been. So there was a peak of interest in terms of people searching the term to find out what it meant. Vox magazine described trauma as word of the decade. And many of the leading lights in terms of who've popularised the terminology around trauma have written books, you know, The Body Keeps the Score, The Myth of Normal. These trauma specialists are now doing podcast tours talking about how what they said has been wildly misinterpreted and how the meaning of the word trauma has been flattened out. Now, that's a trade-off between popularising a term for the betterment of something and people understanding it, but then also it being subject to many different interpretations which create a lack of clarity around what we're talking about. So I go with the trauma's not the story about what happened. Trauma's the wound to your nervous system. It's a bodily thing. How many of you feel that when I say that? That feels true. That feels true, doesn't it? It's the body. The body knows before the mind has made sense of it. What the mind is always rushing to do is create the story that helps us to feel like we understand what's going on. But sometimes the stories that we tell ourselves about the trauma involve taking massive leaps. It's true that I experienced adversity and kind of some forms of neglect and abuse as a child. But I can never know what my mother's motivations were for that. I can never know, did she mean to do that because she hated me? But there was a time where that was my story. And there was a time when I was telling everybody that whenever I told the story. And so I never healed because there are aspects of that story I have to accept that while some things happened, I'm never going to know the full truth about why it happened. And the speculation sometimes prolongs the pain and moves me out of alignment with the truth, which is creating the conditions for depression and anxiety I find myself in life when I'm living out of alignment with the truth. I'm experiencing a lot of those, what we'd call depression and anxiety, not clinically. It's been popularised to a point where it's become the answer to every question for some people. And I just want to make sure that, you know, we're using it appropriately as possible and being mindful about when the word is deployed, not just in terms of our own experience, but any sort of public engagement at all. Thanks very much for your question.
Before we take our next question, can I just ask, is any of the many younger people in the audience who'd like to ask a question, just think your question out and then stick your hand up and I'll try and get to somebody for the next question.
I've got someone at the front here as well who's waiting patiently.
Hi there. Hi, I work as a clinical psychologist in the NHS and I do lots of work with complex trauma. And sadly, obviously, there's not capacity for us to see people, there's long waiting lists. I wonder what your thoughts are about what you would like to see going forward in terms of what the NHS is offering regarding trauma, and also what you might see as a sort of wider societal narrative about how we move towards supporting people who aren't going to be able to access services or aren't going to get into services, what that might look like.
Thanks for the question, and it's good that someone working in the kind of clinical space is sort of come into the conversation I've been engaging with a lot of mental health professionals throughout the course of this, the British Psychological Society. I did a couple of events with them. I've been travelling around doing events with... I even went and met with my old child psychologist because I was like three quarters of the way into a book and then I realised I hadn't actually verified if I had trauma. That's how real my story felt. I was like, I'll be the one to write the book about trauma. And then I was like, did I get diagnosed with trauma? Like, so I had to go and speak to my child psychologist and interview her. And was like, when we did this EMDR therapy, was that because you thought I had trauma? And then we sort of, I got a bit of insight into the state I was in as a teenager. But back then, there were services that you could get referred to and access relatively quickly. The current trauma discourse that I'm talking about and that people, you and people in your field are abundantly aware of and the damaging effects of it, you also understand that it's occurring in a vacuum of services and professional insight. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we should prize professional insight over all other forms of experience or intuition. Of course not. But there really is nothing better for treating trauma and understanding trauma than a great therapist. Someone who understands not just the mechanics of trauma in a physiological sense, but also the rapport that's necessary to guide someone through their understanding, to accept that there might be parts of the story they can let go of, to trust that moving forward you're not stepping into an abyss where you lose your identity or where you're suddenly exposed to danger that might overwhelm you. Unfortunately, what people are doing in the absence, not just of mental health professionals, but any kind of health help, we're losing faith that this is a country where you can get that stuff. Increasingly, we turn to the internet for answers about what's wrong with us. And so concurrent to the collapse in public services, we have this eruption of people trying to get insight into what they suffer from. But anyone who knows about healing from trauma will know there's three distinct stages to it. There's awareness building, there's processing, and then there's releasing. We have a culture where everyone's stuck at the awareness building. They just keep walking around the buffet going, yep, I'll have that. Yep, I'll have that. That's a trauma response. Yep, I'll have that. My ex is a narcissist. Yep, I'll have that. Type 2 ADHD. Because we get this sense that we're making progress. We get this sense we're getting insight and that helps us to feel safe and secure for a while. But there's no action plan. There's no what do we do. There's no what happens when we actually get triggered. We just slip into the same old patterns and the same old lifestyle. We need a therapist to talk frankly to us sometimes to help us through that. And unfortunately, we just don't have that right now. I have no idea how we're going to get to the place we need to get to. But I do think there is a way for some of us who have navigated it to at least dispense some non-clinical suggestions about how not to make the situation worse, i.e. maybe check your story's true before you write a book about it. Do you know? That might be one way to minimise trauma. Maybe check your story's true before you do a Netflix documentary about it. Not everyone, that'll apply to everyone, but the veracity of the story and the movie, all of these things are important for understanding what it is that we're actually dealing with. Thanks for your question. One more.
Thank you, Darren. I also have a trauma diagnosis, so actually it was really helpful to hear kind of how articulate you are about it. My question really is about the whole phrase trauma dumping and how that's become kind of quite common on Instagram and other social media platforms and then kind of entered common parlance. And I find it a really troubling phrase. And then people's responses of this person trauma dumped on me or that kind of thing. I just wondered if you could comment on that and kind of how that relationality of when we share things.
So we're living in an age where we are the product, right? So we get access to these high-tech platforms for free. And in exchange, we are the product. We're being sold, our attention span is being sold to advertisers. Our conversations, the things that we're searching, it's all been packaged up, sent as a profile to all sorts of people who are then targeting us with ads based on our subconscious minds. And one of the other after effects of social media and that form of communication is that when we come to see ourselves as products, then our experiences are commodities, and when we offer them up willingly in any context, we get a fleeting sense of gratification from that. And that's how the social media hacks into our mind. But what it also does is, when we have a trauma discourse, which is all about storytelling, but there's no caveats, as in, there's an appropriate place to tell your story. It might be in a room with a therapist. It might be in a mental health group. It might be with a family member who you know is not going to have a big adverse reaction that's going to upset you more. All we hear is, tell your story. There's no, have you considered the implications of doing that? Who's connected with your story? Do they feel comfortable being jigsaw identified as part of your personal catharsis on social media? Will other people contest the truth of the story? How will that feel to you if you feel publicly visible, even on a Facebook post where you have just trauma dumped and then someone saying, no, that never happened, you're a liar, you're saying that for attention? All the stuff that happens in toxic family structures. If we're sharing from a place of woundedness without any understanding that sharing the story is only half of what's supposed to happen. We share the story to let the people that have organised and situated themselves around us to help us know what's going on in our mind. They then get to interrogate that. But we have this kind of individualist, this is my truth. This truth cannot be subjected to any form of scrutiny or criticism, because that's injurious to me, because my truth is my entire sense of identity and security. And so the trauma dumping phenomenon is really when I think people practice poor boundaries. And I've done it and continue to do it, and I've probably done it a few times throughout the course of this event. But I understand how to do the repair after it. Catharsis culture is what I call it in the book. It's when we're only thinking about getting out of the discomfort we're in right now, short term. We don't like everything that comes back at us. So sharing is not just about the exhibition of hearing ourselves talk about the story. We also have to have a closed mouth friend with insight, whatever form that takes, to say, okay, you've told me the story. Do you notice that it's different from the last time you told me the story? Why is that? Do you notice that there's a bit you left out? Are you sure that happened that way that you said it for that reason that you said it? Because that seems to be causing you a lot of pain. That's not going to happen on Twitter, is it? It's not going to happen on Instagram. The people who are a bit more conservative, we're talking about their private life, they're often regarded as old fuddy-duddies who close everything behind a locked door and they don't want to confront things, but actually there's something in what they do. There's something in having a stiffer upper lip. There's something in keeping your powder dry. It's because they know as soon as the thing is in the public, you have the risk of complicating it, scandalising yourself, being subject to harsh judgment from people who don't have any insight. And so, yeah, whether it's trauma dumping or whatever you want to call it, always be compassionate in the face of somebody who's oversharing. But if there's somebody close to you, get in about them and say, look, this is the sort of stuff maybe we could talk about over a coffee in a private space to protect the integrity of the details. Is that us then? Thanks very much for your question. Thanks very much. I know that was a bit difficult at points, but that's what recovering from trauma is all about.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.